I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is April 9th, 2024. We do have a quorum present. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes for April 4th, 2024. Lead Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be glad to move the minutes of, what was it?
April 4th.
April 4th, 2024.
All right. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Just some reminders today. Everyone in this hearing room must be seated unless you are entering or exiting the room. There will be no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. Please do not approach the testifier table unless staff or I have authorized you to come up as a speaker. And if you need further accommodations, you can communicate that with Sergeant Staff. Cheering, clapping, and other disruptive behavior is not allowed in the hearing room. If you are being disruptive, you will be asked to leave. Finally, all of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided the time limit for their testimony and are fully aware of that. We ask that everyone please adhere to those limits. And I'm hoping that Chair Pinto will walk in the room at any moment to do his bill. He was going to gavel in room 200 and come down. So 'tis the season. There we go. Chair Pinto. welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much.
I will move to re-refer House Bill 5033 back to Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee and also send Chair Pinto back to Children and Families
yes.
Committee. We do have a DE2, so I will move the DE2. All those in favor of the DE2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE2 is adopted. Chair Pinto, to your bill as amended.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So members, House File 5033 was really a bill to get two other bills before this committee. We're trying to sort of do some maneuvering. And the first of those bills takes up most of the bill of the DE2. It's House File 4697, and it has to do with reforming the state's process for reviewing when a child dies or nearly dies as a result of maltreatment. And so that process has been was identified in a Star Tribune series recently as being a really problematic process right now, complicated, cumbersome, confusing, and problematic in other ways, which I'll be happy to get into. The portion of this committee's jurisdiction within that bill, and so within that DE2, is the portion that has to do with data practices immunity. I don't actually have the DE2 right in front of me, but it's a number of pages in, I believe it's subdivision 5, and that language, paragraphs, are within the committee's jurisdiction. I will note that it's modeled entirely on the process for data practice immunity for the current fatality review process developed by Lead Scott and by Representative Moeller. Thank you so much. And Representative Moeller, with just two small changes, which I'll point out to you in 1 second. And so in the DE2, line 7.8, it says the commissioner shall disclose information regarding a critical incident upon request. Under current law, it says the commissioner may disclose that information, and we want to make sure that that information does, in fact, get disclosed. And then finally, at the top of page 8, it provides, this is a new provision providing immunity for somebody presenting information or gathering information from liability relating to the presentation of information to this panel. We want to make sure, unless there's the person is acting in bad faith, we want to make sure that folks feel free to share information in these reviews. These are not investigations, I want to emphasize. There's a separate criminal investigation, maltreatment investigation, employment investigation. This is something just stepping back and doing a systemic review. And then the final piece, the bottom of page 8 is, I believe it's House File 4727. It would establish, as you can see, a Supreme Court counsel on child protection that over an 18-month period, working with multiple branches, multiple backgrounds, to say how can we improve our child protection system. Happy to answer more questions about that. I have no testifiers, and thank you, Chair, for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Representative Pinto. And I will note, members, just because sometimes the lines between our branches of government can sometimes get blurry, I will just clarify that we are inviting the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to set up this council. And you'll see there's a letter in your packet that our current Chief Justice Hudson is supportive of these efforts. And so this has been a joint effort, but we are not telling the judicial branch what they must do. We are inviting them to set up a council as they have are supportive of the work that we're doing. So with that, are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right, not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Chair Pinto. I'm intrigued on this. I think it's an important issue, but the only question I have is when these reviews start going on, this before, during, or after the law enforcement death investigation?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. This would generally be after the investigation. I'm going to need to just catch up my brain a little bit about, I believe, so this is going to be after maltreatment determination is made. It's possible that there could be a portion of investigation occurring, but I believe there's weird language in here that kind of allows, I mean, certainly, and you know I'm a prosecutor, this is, would be important to me to not get in the way of a criminal investigation. And in general, it's going to take some time before this begins. So maybe I'll leave it at that for now.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckman, Chair Pinto, we're somewhat in agreement on this, that the investigation and the court trial must go through before this review because it could cause some issues in that during the trial portion.
Representative Pinto?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to clarify, Representative Johnson, so certainly that's the case regarding the investigation. I will say that right now, one of the many problems with the current system is that we wait until all litigation is concluded, which means that a death might have occurred 8 or 9 years ago by the time the review issues a report, because if you wait all these years for things to happen, most states do not wait for the end of litigation, meaning either criminal litigation or civil litigation. So we're very much an outlier in states doing that. And so this is set up so that, you know, the investigation may well be concluded. It may be that there may be a court process that's happening, and that's why we want to make sure this is sort of cordoned off from that. There's not, there are separate processes going on, because that's true in most states. We just don't want to have to wait so long.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker and Chair Pinto, I'm concerned about the first court hearing, the first determination. Whatever happens after that, this review could go on, but I think we should wait till after that first determination.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the good conversations we've had on this, Chair Pinto. And I think it's really important work that's long overdue, and I think the new setup of what you're doing in this will be one that is, I think it'll just it'll be more thorough, and I hope that it will be more thorough. And for other members of the committee, I did share with Chair Pinto, several other states are already doing this. And yes, this is the report that I gave a copy to. I think that's Kentucky. There are several states. Oregon have some great data. And what I want to refer to here is the annual report. And right now, the language in this bill says that the commissioner shall publish a report of the review panel. And the report shall include, but is not limited to, de-identified summary data. This is on page 8.7 and following. Not be limited to data on the number of critical incidents reported to the panel, the number of critical incidents reviewed by the panel, and local review teams and systemic learnings identified by the panel and teams and so forth. These reports that other states are doing are so thorough. They have so many really good data points that I think I would hope that the department would look at some of what's happening in other states and look at that data and do their report based on some of those. And I know you don't want to delineate what those other data sets are right now, but I do hope that the department will look deeply into that, because I think those reports are so good, and they give a summary even in there of some of these incidences, and then they give recommendations to the legislature based on what they've learned by all the data points and by looking at all this. So I think it would really help inform the legislature and the public on the decisions that are made going forward to close any you know, issues that are out there that are keeping kids at risk. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, closing comments, Representative Pinto.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. And, yeah, Lead Scott, I really appreciate our conversations as well, and happy to continue discussing those that area with you, those lines 8.10 to 8.12, because as I'm looking at it, I could certainly imagine, I don't want to be too prescriptive at the start and too detailed, but I could imagine there may be sort of an additional, you know, phrase or two in terms of describing the kind of things we're wanting to get at in the report. And even as I'm looking at it now, I'm having some ideas about that. So let's continue to talk. And thank you, Chair and members. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 5033 as amended to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
Heading back. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Next up, I have Representative Egbadje on House File 685. So I will move to re-refer House File 685 as we're picking this back up. We had already heard this before and taken testimony and done some amendments there. So I will move to re-refer House File 685 as amended back to the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. So we did adopt, they are in your packets, we did adopt the A1 and A2 amendments on March 22nd before we laid the bill over, but because we didn't send it out of our committee, it did not get engrossed. So that's why there's kind of some extra amendments in your packets. Representative Egbadje, I understand that you have an author's amendment that replaces the A2 amendment we adopted on March 22nd. Is that correct?
Yes, okay. That is correct. Okay.
So I will move to reconsider adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right. The motion prevails. And so now I will move the A3 author's amendment for adoption. Representative Egbadje, please tell us about the A3.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. It's good to be in front of you again. We had a very robust discussion on House File 685 with the previous amendment. From that discussion, as well as ones that ensued afterwards, this amendment comes forward because of that. So just to refresh, House File 685 is meant to begin addressing the trend of corporate and investor owners in the housing market. Based on our own discussion some weeks ago and more with interested parties, the amendment in front of you seeks to address some of those comments. So this amendment clarifies some language with a couple of significant changes. The discussion on what to do when a corporate owner has more than 10 properties is nuanced. And while there are a number of options, including divestiture, we do need to know about additional safeguards to put in place to prevent inadvertent displacement of tenants. So that remedy is currently removed right now. And then we'll keep talking as we figure out a way to actually make that remedy hopefully work. But the remedy that does remain in the bill, which is still in the A3 amendment, is that there would be a fine for corporations that continue to own and rent more than 10 properties. The bill also adds a registry and disclosure requirement so that tenants know who their corporate landlords are. I've heard in various conversations that this is actually probably a helpful piece to determine the implementation of really just understanding the baseline of who the corporate players in Minnesota are right now. And so that way we can better keep track of who is actually in compliance with this bill should this be enacted. The creation of the registry will be a repository of the landlords in the state, and similarly a disclosure rule of the entity to tenants can be useful should a tenant want to report a violation of this bill. With those additional changes, it will require an updated fiscal note, which is part of the reason we're sending it back to the Housing Committee so we can continue to work on those details to develop a process to track these violations and track how best to engage on the enforcement. And with that, happy to take further questions.
All right. Committee discussion to the A3. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Pinn, Representative Adjaye, with the amendment that we're looking at. On 2.1 and 2.2, it says a complete legal names of each natural person who has an economic interest in the residential building. We have corporate investors that actually have stock, and many pension funds provide that buy that stock. So now you're looking at every TSA person that's on the pension because they have stock and it's in their pension funds. Every single one of them has to be listed. Unless they divest from the investment stock. So it's getting to the point where with this amendment, there is nobody that would be providing housing for the for citizens of Minnesota unless they're, you know, I think you still have the nonprofits listed as exempt, unless they're a nonprofit agency or company. But like I said, we have a lot of people that have stock in these companies that are doing this, and you're taking that away from them. Can you explain why you're doing that?
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question. I mean, I think essentially this bill still goes back to the fact of we want to ensure that those who are in this market are actual people, especially people who have families, might be looking for their starter home. So if it's a pension group that you're pointing at, I'm trying to look at the amendment and follow where you were. I'm sorry, I had a lot of pages in front of me. You know, I don't know if a pension group is necessarily the best entity to be holding onto housing. We just want to make sure that the market has enough freedom in it so that way individuals and families can be able to purchase a home.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerman, Representative Bajay. The actual numbers for in a statewide that is corporate owned is very small. Statewide, I think it's around less than 2%. While the city of Minneapolis owns 7%, just in one of their nonprofits that they operate. So I think we really need to take a look at this. Under the Obama administration, people were encouraged to purchase properties, fix them up, especially the blighted properties, fix them up and rent them out. So that people did that. And now you're going to punish them and force them to sell their properties or go through 10,000 hoops in order to keep them and fine them, if there's a, if I remember correctly, is a fine of up to $100,000 per unit. We want to get people housing. We don't want them homeless. This is going to do the exact opposite.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Agbaje, I wanted to touch on the substitution of a divestment requirement for the $100,000 civil fine per unit. I'm just wondering whether that's actually even worse. I mean, if we're talking about a portfolio of even 20 homes, that means that you're raising the cost of each home by $50,000. I mean, that money is not just going to fall out of the sky. That money is passed on to the renters. Is that, I mean, that's functionally the same as a divestment or a requirement, or it's just harming the renters at that point. Where did the $100,000 civil fine come from, and is that really a better solution?
Representative Agbaje, and I will thank you, Representative Niska, for stating her name correctly. She has served in this body for, this is her fourth year serving with us, so I would hope that others will try a little bit harder to say your name correctly. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. No, that's a great question about, you know, kind of the remedy, right? I think that's the conversations that we've been having that we had here a couple weeks ago. So the approach with the fine is to ensure that that this actually becomes a harder market for corporations to be involved in, because again, we want to free up those homes for individuals. So if they, the way that the bill is currently structured, if they do decide to come into this market, should they move past the 10 unit limit, they would then have that $100,000 fine. That's a number that we believe should hopefully disincentivize corporations to want to come into the market. I don't know what those corporations would do to, you know, make up that fine in their bottom line. But at least for us, what we propose to do is put the revenue that would come from that into a fund that would continue to support either the building of affordable housing or ensuring that more people could go into affordable housing.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Agbaje. Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that the bigger we're talking about the real problem with the divestment idea as a remedy is if there is a corporate owner that has a portfolio that's bigger than 10 right now, and what this is doing is either forcing them to divest, and the bigger they are, the bigger their portfolio is right now, the harder the penalty is. Probably that's going to fall either on the housing market in general or on the renters who rent from that corporate owner. So I would suggest, I guess, continuing to work on finding a different remedy, because I don't think that's really, if you're trying to solve the problem that divestment remedy solves, I don't think that's solving it. I would also encourage you to look more into who are the ultimate shareholders of a lot of the corporations that do invest in housing, because it is actually pretty typical for pension funds, retirement accounts, et cetera, to be investing in a diversified portfolio, including in investing in Minnesota housing. And so I think you're potentially going to, like Representative Johnson said, wrap up a lot of folks other than the fat cats that you think you're applying this to.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief. I just want to thank you, Rep. Agbaje, for I had reached out after the last hearing with the concerns, just specifically with group homes, and I really appreciate that you took the time to take a meeting to discuss that further and incorporate it in the amendment. So I really appreciate your work on this.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Agbaje, thank you for being here today. Just trying to get to the data portion of this. You're setting up this new database, and what are your goals for this database? Why set something like this up?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. So the database came to us because a lot of folks were saying, how would you even know who these corporate entities are when they reach the 10 limit? How would we get to know who they are? And if they have various other subsidiary companies, how do we know that they all kind of go back into one company? So the idea of a registry was that folks would have to basically disclose that they are purchasing properties in Minnesota, that they are renting them, and if they have additional subsidiaries related to them. We wanted to be able to have a centralized location for the state to be able to check against that, to understand how many properties were actually being held, to see if they would be in violation should this be enacted.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Agbaje, most cities do licensing for all the rental properties. And it's public information now. You just have to request it of the city, who owns the property, how many units are there. And so that is public information right now. And so I question the need for doing this. And Representative Agbaje, if that's the information you want to get at, why are you asking for rent amounts?
Representative Agbaje.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I mean, I think that that's just something for folks to be able to know as they're entering the marketplace, particularly if they're looking at landlords. But if there is a significant concern about how that affects the specific housing market for purchasing housing, that's something we can discuss.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for saying that you're willing, Representative Agbaje, to discuss that. I think that would be very, very harmful in the rental market in particular, because landlords they're going to look at, okay, this is a similar property to mine. They're getting $25 more per month rent. They're getting $100 more per month rent than we are, so I'm going to raise my rent. And you're going to drive up the cost. And quite frankly, it's none of the government's business what I'm charging for rent, unless it's a Section 8 property or something like that. It's none of the government's business. The market will determine that. It's a private contract between a renter and a housing provider. So I just have a real problem with putting out there what the rent amounts are. And I don't see a need for this database at all. And the other concern I have is if you're putting down, you know, the residential unit. You live at 1234 Main Street, apartment number 12. In my mind, a person can do a reverse lookup and find out who the tenant is. And that's putting tenants at risk as well. So I hope that you'll rethink that whole portion of this amendment that's now part of the bill. So thank you, Madam Chair. And I would ask for a roll call.
Roll call having been requested, Representative Ekbadje, closing comments on the A3 amendment.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I think this is, you know, great feedback that we can use as we continue to pursue this bill. Again, the purpose is to figure out all the various tools that we have to ensure that housing is more accessible to more people in Minnesota. So thank you for the committee's time.
All right. With that, the clerk will, I will renew my motion to adopt the A3 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Fenn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier excused. Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
Representative Curran. 6 ayes, 5 nays.
With 6 ayes and 5 nays, the amendment is adopted. We do have a couple more amendments. Representative Ekbadje.
God, I thought that was the main one. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yep. No, we've got a couple more, and then I'm guessing you want us to move your bill. I mean, that was a very in-depth discussion of an amendment. I will give you that much. The next up that we have is the A4. Representative Scott, I believe that's your amendment. If you'd like to move it and then speak to your amendment.
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I brought this up in the last committee hearing we had on this bill, but there's no reason we should be exempting nonprofits and cities. They are, quote unquote, almost like corporate landlords that you're trying to get at in this bill overall. So they buy up properties as well. And as Representative Johnson said before, that the city and local governments actually own more property than these corporations. And so we want to make an even playing field here. And so that's what this amendment does, is it removes the exclusions for nonprofits and for cities. And I would encourage members to support.
Representative Ekbadje to the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to recommend a no vote on this amendment. So the issue with housing is that it's becoming much more commodified, and that housing is being used as a way to make profits. It is actually a necessity for people where they live, where they take care of their families, where they go to from school and work, and it's also a place of refuge. From what we've been seeing in the marketplace, both from either a rental perspective or a home ownership perspective, it's much harder for people to be able to find that accessibility into housing, particularly when a number of corporations continue to see the property as a source of income for themselves, unrelated to whether the person who's living there has an increase in income on their own. What nonprofits and the government has been able to do in this space, while not perfect, is also they are able to provide that housing at a much more affordable rate, particularly from the nonprofit sector. And we all know that the government is the major provider in public housing, which often is at a third of someone's rent or even a lower nominal fee based on if the person has the ability to work or not. So with that, I would encourage a no vote on this amendment.
Right. Representative Niska to the A4.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ekbadje, for, I think, clarifying the real philosophical difference at the heart of this, which is about whether capitalism is a useful tool to encourage investment in things that are helpful to people. I think that you know, if you believe that the government nonprofit industrial complex is the perfect and central planning is the perfect way to allocate resources, then having governments and government funded nonprofits control the essentials of life is the right way to go. If you think that private investment and the marketplace and people in voluntary exchange, someone selling someone to something, selling someone a good or service based on a voluntary transaction between them, and private investment into the marketplace is a useful thing, maybe not the only good thing, but at least a useful thing, then I think that putting private investment on at least the same playing field as nonprofits and government is an important value that we should be trying to preserve in our state. And I think, Representative Scott, thank you for, I think, this amendment, which goes at the concern that was expressed last time, what I heard from you, Representative Agbaje, is that we're concerned about private homeowners or private single families being able to compete in the marketplace and not be crowded out by bigger players who go out and monopolize all the housing in the marketplace. And those big players can be nonprofits just as well as they can be private investors. In fact, those are the big players right now in Minnesota, are the nonprofits. And so if we're trying to serve that goal, then we should cut the nonprofit government complex out of the game of scooping up single family homes as well and taking them away from the single family buyers. So I think this is a good amendment if we're trying to accomplish the goals that you set out in the last hearing on this bill.
Representative Johnson to the A4.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Badgett, Representative Niska, thank you for this amendment. Representative Scott, I'm sorry.
No, I'm not stealing that.
How dare.
One of those days looking up information.
Representative Johnson.
We recently, the Minneapolis Housing Authority just testified in the Housing Committee wanting $35 million to fix up property. That's how much they're behind on their, with their Minneapolis-owned nonprofit for doing maintenance. Deferred maintenance on the single-family homes and rental units they have. We learned that they own 7% of rental units, which includes single-family homes, that have been taken out of the market for individuals to purchase. So I want to thank Representative Scott for putting this in, because nonprofits should be included in this. Last year in the Housing Committee, I had $1.12 billion available for nonprofits for housing. That's the tax dollars of the state of Minnesota. The vast majority went into the metro area. And we have, today we're hearing over $200 million worth of more money for the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. People in Minnesota are getting tired of nonprofits taking their tax dollars. It is time for them to pull their boots on, and if they're going to be a nonprofit, find other sources of funding other than the back pockets of the citizens of Minnesota.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, excuse me, and Representative Agbaje for your bill. I just wanted to say that I think part of why we're seeing a shift towards nonprofits is because we have seen the way that our private investment in the housing industry over the last forever has really driven these disparities. Nonprofits aren't perfect. City ownership isn't perfect, but we know what the purpose of a corporation is. The legally mandated purpose of a corporation is not to provide housing. It is to drive profits for shareholders. It is the only thing they are responsible for. And the idea that Minnesotans are tired of nonprofits taking their tax dollars as opposed to corporations not paying taxes is laughable. We need to make sure that people are getting housing. It is the purpose of what we are doing here. We are supposed to, and nonprofits and cities, although they often fail, they are responsible to the outcomes, not to profits. So thank you for drawing that line. It is a philosophical difference, Representative Niska, and providing housing is what our side's philosophy is about, not providing profit.
Closing comments on the A4 amendment, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the discussion today. I would like to request a roll call on this amendment. I just want folks to really think hard and do some homework on nonprofits. It sounds all altruistic, but if you look at some of these top dogs at these nonprofits, they're making six figures, seven figures. So don't be misguided by the word nonprofit. Members, I ask for a green vote on this very sensible, even playing field amendment. Thank you.
All right. Representative Scott renews her motion to move the A4 amendment. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Fenn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier excused. Minority Leader Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
Nope.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
Five ayes, seven nays.
With five ayes and seven nays, the amendment is not adopted. Next up, we have the A5 amendment. Representative Niska, I think, is that one yours?
This one is.
Yes, all right. Representative Niska, would you like to move the A5 and then speak to your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A5 amendment and request a roll call. The A5 amendment, again, is getting to the same idea as Representative Scott's amendment. We are, again, trying to make sure that we're reaching the goal of or helping the bill achieve its goal better of taking the huge players out who are just going to roll up all these single family homes and allow for the families who want to go out and buy a home to not have to compete with the big players. And so if we're trying to do that, then we should also make sure that this applies to big government instead of just big corporations. Big government is actually the bigger player in cooperation with the big nonprofit sector. That's actually the big concern in Minnesota in terms of actually reaching that issue about crowding out families who want to buy homes out of the single family market. And yes, Representative Finke, we all want housing, but the question is, how do we get investment in that housing? Is the investment going to be all taxpayer dollars taken by the government, chosen by central planners here at the legislature, or are we going to encourage private investment to come into the housing market? If we want just only big government and only big nonprofit funded by big government to be the ones that roll up the single family homes, then we should do the bill the way that Representative Agbaje has it. But if we want to treat big government and big business the same way, then we should vote for the A5 amendment.
All right. Representative Agbaje to the A5.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. Again, to the committee members, I would encourage a no vote on this amendment, similar to the last one. The goal of government in housing is to provide housing for people. While we can have a discussion on the many shortcomings of how government has done that or not done that, they still are a major player in that around the country and in Minnesota. We want to be sure that they are the ones that are also still available to have access to be able to support people if they want to buy homes, whether that's through down payment assistance programs that we instituted last year, or that's through helping to support the building of more homes across our state. I think what is happening is we're sort of conflating the bigness of government and the bigness of corporations. In corporations, again, as we've heard, their sole purpose is to make a profit. Their sole purpose is to use housing as a commodity, as to buy and sell on their books numbers back and forth. There is not much consideration for the tenants who live in those homes, as we saw with the Havenbrook homes that our Attorney General's office went after a couple years ago. Those homes are now being sold to nonprofits, government entities who can help with ensuring that they actually enter back into the marketplace so that way individual families can be the purchasers of those homes. So again, I do think this points to a philosophical difference about the approach to housing and whether housing is a commodity or not. So I would encourage members a no vote on this amendment.
Further discussion to the A5, Representative Curran.
First, thank you, Chair, for the slight departure in conversation from our committee's jurisdiction. I really appreciate that this morning. Rep. Agbaje, I appreciate your comments, and I agree with your recommendation for a no vote for this, and I'll say that it's because of our state government's lack of funding the services that are crucial for people to thrive in Minnesota is why we're in situations like this where nonprofits are having to provide homes for people and provide services for people. Coming from a nonprofit background, I can tell you that all of the nonprofits I've ever worked with over 20 years have all said they would love to be out of business if it meant that the state was adequately funding the services and the housing that people needed. So it's not for the money, and I really appreciate that you have this perspective in mind, understanding that nonprofits and the government have to come in and help out because our basics are that we're providing are not enough. And so, I would encourage folks maybe to look at this in a broader angle, and if this isn't acceptable, then I would welcome some work to increase funding for housing and services at the state level from our colleagues. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments on the A5, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Speaker Madam Chair. Sorry. Maybe before you leave, you'll get to be up there a few times.
I've done it a couple times. It's fine. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Agbaje. Appreciate the discussion. I think you're oversimplifying the purpose of a corporation and how corporations' pursuit of profits encourages investment. Investment in housing is good. Not all corporations obviously are perfect, and the Havensbrook example was referenced. That's why we have consumer protections. That's why we have, I think, good bipartisan work on a lot of that kind of stuff, where we try to rein in problems in the private sector. But we have to be realistic about the problems in the nonprofit sector and the problems in the government sector. And I think it is overly simplistic and frankly naive to say that government that the sole purpose of government in providing and getting into this is to provide housing. The sole purpose of government is to get politicians reelected by making people vote for them, and a lot of times that means getting people dependent on what the government is going to give them, especially in this space. So if we want to empower people, if we want to empower people to invest in this space, if we want to empower people to buy their own homes, or maybe even, God forbid, to be an investor in real estate and to maybe work them their way up to somebody who is able to have a portfolio of 11 or 12 single-family homes, then we should be, rethinking the approach of this bill. If we want governments and nonprofits to own all the single-family homes in the state and then for people to have to reelect politicians in order to stay dependent on them, then this is a good approach. I think that if we want to accomplish the goals of your bill, we should treat government and nonprofits and big business on an equal playing field, and that's the point of the A5 amendment. I encourage members to vote yes.
All right, Representative Niska renews his motion to move the A5 amendment. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Fenn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier excused. Minority Leet Scott.
Aye.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Vice.
No.
Representative Finke.
No.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Niska.
Yes.
Representative Weens.
Aye.
5 ayes, 7 nays.
5 ayes, 7 nays. The amendment is not adopted. All right, now we're done with amendments. To the underlying bill as amended, as we noted, we took public testimony. I think we've had a thorough debate on the pros and cons of this bill via the amendments, but we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the good discussion this morning, and I won't rehash what's already been rehashed. I think we've talked about a lot of the issues that the bill has, and I would just encourage people to vote against this bill, and I would request a roll call.
Representative Johnson.
She already spoke.
Okay, great. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 685 as amended to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier excused. Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller. Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
Representative Moeller. 6 ayes, 5 nays.
With 6 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is on its way back to Housing, Finance, and Policy. Now you can leave, Representative Badger.
I will be back.
Yes. get a drink of water. Representative Stevenson. I will move House File 5282 before the committee, and then I will note that this is clone language to another Representative Stevenson bill, but we're just talking about the civil law and data provisions related to cannabis regulations. There is also an A1 amendment. Representative Stevenson, would you like us to take care of that amendment first?
Yes, please.
All right. I will move the A1 amendment before the committee. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. The amendment is adopted. The bill is now in the shape you would like. Representative Stevenson, 25282 as amended.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill is assorted provisions related to the Office of Cannabis Management's policy bill that they brought to the legislature this year that fall within the jurisdiction of this committee. It relates to certain disqualifications, expanding their inspection authority to make sure they can do a good job of ensuring that people are complying with the new regulations. It also deals with some data as we transfer some components of MDH over to OCM. Happy to answer questions.
All right.
And I think we have.
If one testifier signed up, is she testifying or just here for questions?
Are you?
Great. Just here for questions. any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for actually doing this and getting this in bill form. My one concern, and I don't know, other than maybe putting audit trails in here, my one concern with this moving the medical cannabis program into the broader program is that we're moving medical records into an area that has never experienced taking care of medical records, and that gives me a lot of concern, and so I hope that that's something that we'll watch very closely. It's kind of late in the game, but I would like to see maybe some audit trails or something just so that if there's some sort of breach or whatever, we have a way of tracking back to what happened there. So anytime you're dealing with people's medical information, such sensitive information, it kind of raises my ire a little bit. So thank you, Madam Chair. It's my only comment.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Stevenson.
I think that's a fair point, Representative Scott, and we can work on that.
All right. And we're not moving this anywhere. So without further discussion, we have now fully vetted the provisions in your bill. With that, I will lay over House File 5282 as amended. Last up today, Representative Agbaji, that wasn't a very long rest.
It's okay. I'm
here. Welcome back.
Hello.
I will move to refer House File 912 to the Ways and Means Committee. And you know, we have an A3 amendment, so I will move the A3 amendment. to get it in the shape you would like. All those in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Egbadje, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm presenting House File 912, which is also known as the African American Family Preservation Act or the Layla Jackson Act. The purpose of this bill is to keep black families in Minnesota intact when they first come in contact with child protective services. Family separation has long been and continues to be a scourge of American society, with families of color especially feeling the brunt of the disruption, trauma, and pain. Even now, it is families of color that are disproportionately overrepresented in the CPS system as compared to their population in the state. These families find themselves at the mercy of a court system they know little about, with limited legal support. They are also at a disadvantage when engaging with workers who may not understand the culture of the family and the community. Over the years, this builds a lack of trust and frustration in the system on behalf of families and staff. This bill attempts to begin to address some of those disparities. The data from DHS shows that African American, Hispanic, and children of two or more races are 2 to 7 times more likely than their white counterparts to be in out-of-home care compared to white children for similar types of offenses. It is noted that these disparities are a result of caseworkers assessing homes and often instituting removal proceedings even when there are no egregious allegations of harm. Often caseworkers may see a family in poverty, which manifests in housing insecurity or job insecurity or food insecurity, and instead of providing resources for the family to secure better housing, education, employment, food, or health care, removing children is seen as the response for a family that's in poverty. And that's actually more costly than providing the resources directly to the families that are poor. And it should not be the decision of the state to decide whether or not poor people can raise their own children. In order to provide some protections when facing the intricacies of the county and court systems, this bill seeks to require that counties engage the African American Child's Family Network, provide support to obtain services or resources for the family, a right to counsel for emergency removal hearings, specify that a court cannot terminate an African American parent's rights on the sole basis of failure to complete a case plan, and provide for cultural competency training for county staff. Through this bill, it would require counties to use active efforts to preserve the family, or should out-of-home placement be needed, find safe, willing, and able adults in the family network to care for the child. This bill has gone through revisions to address concerns that varied interested parties have had in implementing this bill. One significant change is to expanding the need of active efforts to other children who are disproportionately represented in the system, whether that's based on race, ethnicity, disability, or income status. The bill also notes that poverty should not be conflated with neglect, and the bill provides for grant funding to help families with material needs. The bill also begins to tighten language to ensure that children will get closer to a permanent placement, ideally with their own parents or with someone in their family or in kin network if reunification with a parent is not a safe option. The bill also codifies two policy efforts in DHS to ensure that cases of black children are properly reviewed and addressed. The African American Child Family Wellbeing Unit and the African American Child Wellbeing Advisory Council both work with families and with the government to ensure better collaboration through recommendations and policy guidance related to the child protection system. Finally, this bill is about keeping children with safe adults and family members. Should no one be available, there is an opportunity for a child to be placed with someone outside the family. We all know that healthy families are vital to the success of our children and ultimately our state. Everyone has a stake in ensuring that Minnesota's child protection system is fair and equitable. And your support on this bill will help decrease racial disparities and injustices faced by these families. I think I only have two testifiers, and then we'll turn to member discussion.
All right. First up, I have Ms. Houston, and then I have Rhea Bornman Spears on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Khalees Houston, Executive Director of Village Arms, Chair of the NAACP's Child Protection Committee. We're not before you with a new issue. This is a decades-old issue, 50-plus years that we've been dealing with this problem within child protection. Systemic racism exists at every decision point of the child protection process. This issue is one that has plagued the state of Minnesota for the past 50-plus years. African-American families are coming into the system for less serious allegations than our Caucasian peers. yet we continue to face the most harsh and punitive outcomes throughout the life of the case. Our children are up to 7 times more likely to be removed from their home, and our parents are more likely to have their parental rights terminated at the end of their case. According to DHS, little has been effective in reducing the disproportionality between white children and nearly every other race or ethnicity. The African American Family Preservation Act is the solution to this problem, and it has shown that it is effective. We piloted the bill over a 3-year period in Hennepin County. We served over 200 families, and we closed over 90% of our cases without a child removal. We accomplished this by implementing provisions from the bill, such as unique and tailored safety plans, culturally specific service provision, engaging the fathers and extended family at the investigative stage, and allowing the family to dictate what it is that they need. This bill responds to what is happening to our families in practice. It reduces harm to our children, it keeps the family intact, improves the long-term well-being of the children, and will save the state money by reducing the cost of out-of-home placement. This intervention, such as out-of-home placement, is heavily relied upon when the family is black. And this is in spite of decades of research and data that proves we cause more harm to a child when we separate them from their parents and relatives. What we're asking for today is for this state to stop harming our children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Rhea Bornman Spears. And then are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Rhea Bornman Spears. I'm an attorney in the Twin Cities area. I got involved in this work mostly because these were the cases that I kept seeing over and over again, African-American families who were experiencing injustice in the legal system. I know a big part of what's been at issue with this bill and something to consider for this committee, obviously, is the questions about whether it's constitutional and things like that. I just want to say there's been a lot of discussions about that. There's been advice sought. We even went to William Mitchell con law professors. And I want to say that the active efforts part of the bill has been brought up as well. And a big part of the pilot that Ms. Houston talked about that went through Hennepin County, one of the benefits to that was that you could see the actual data and numbers that resulted from implementing that change. And although the part that's argued for constitutionality regarding the active efforts has to do with the judicial oversight, what it really comes down to that the pilot showed was the day-to-day care for the family. So the conversations that were had by the Child Protective Services staff in conjunction with the liaisons that work through Ms. Houston's Village Arms pilot program, and the repeat talks and efforts about brainstorming outside of the box of what was always traditionally done for these different families that were coming in through the pilot. The fact that the pilot worked and that it worked in Hennepin County, the one that has the largest number of child protection cases coming in, should give everyone confidence to pass it. I understand that there's those arguments about constitutionality. I don't think that those merit any further resistance to getting this passed. And as Ms. Houston said, we've been working on this for a long time, and we're looking for a resolution. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Agbaje, for tackling this issue. It's really obviously really important when we're talking about kids, and I appreciate that the discussion is centered on what the best interest is of kids and emphasizing how important family connections are for kids. This topic is personal to our family a little bit, and I've shared a little bit with this committee before when we were talking about the Guardian Ad Litem program about our family's experience. We have a daughter who is my biological niece who was with us in foster care through the child protection system, and it's really, really important that we get this right. And the system isn't perfect, and the reason that I mean, the overriding fundamental reason the system isn't perfect is because human beings run the system, and human beings aren't perfect, and human beings, every single one of us, you know, have biases and mental shortcuts, and sometimes those mental shortcuts are, you know, based on or include factors about race or class or other things, and I appreciate the care that this bill is trying to get at, you know, dealing with those things. I think that this bill probably wouldn't have meaningfully affected our situation, even though our daughter is, her biological father is of African descent. She doesn't even know who he is, and you know, it was good in our situation that there was a real focus on family, on making sure that she was placed and ultimately had permanence with family. And so family is so important, and I appreciate that the emphasis that this is putting on making sure that that kinship, that family connection is held at the center as we're, you know, centering, again, the best interests of the child, because that's what really, I mean, we should, almost nothing else should be important or as important as the best interest of the family. I am interested in learning more about how the Hennepin County program worked out. I'm glad that there is continuing discussion about, you know, trying to avoid potential legal challenges on this. I'm not sure I would necessarily just assume that whatever a Mitchell Hamlin law professor says is
Whoa.
Right.
Whoa.
But no, I appreciate the work that you're putting into this, and obviously the work that that you're doing on behalf of kids. So thank you.
If it matters, for the record, Representative Igbaji and I have also talked to a con law professor from UC Berkeley. So, and since everyone always is talking, you know, Representative Igbaji went to Harvard too.
I'm responding to the testimony.
Yeah. To bring it back, one thing I did want to lift up is how this bill is relevant to the first bill we heard today from Representative Pinto, in that the goal of this Supreme Court Council on Child Protection, one of the duties is to develop a comprehensive blueprint that addresses all aspects of the child protection system. And I think the reality is that there are things that could be improved on across the board. And I think especially now when we have a Supreme Court that looks a little bit more like the people who live in Minnesota, you know, I will just call out that Justice McKeag, decades of experience in the child protection realm. And so I think that's a really good thing that is also moving forward as well. Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bajay, thank you for bringing this bill. I'm glad I made it back to be a part of discussion. And I was kidding with Representative Niska when he made the comments about Mitchell, because I'm an alumni, so tread lightly. but seriously, though, I mean, I wanted to testify or said that, you know, this is something that's been a movement or a battle of advocacy for decades. I would say it's been centuries. You know, this goes back to when the first person was snatched off the shores of a continent far away from here, brought across the ocean to this continent. And families have been separated ever since, and we've been fighting to find ways to implement policies that are actually favorable to keeping those families together. And I think Representative Niska said it best, is that, you know, these systems are made up and run by people, and those biases are baked in. They've always been baked in. And this is a tool. All we're trying to do is ensure that we have some type of equity in terms of how we deal with these situations to ensure that we don't continue to have the harm that has been done over centuries. Not decades, centuries. The disparities we see today, they're not by happenstance. We can draw a through line all the way back to when the first families were snatched apart. We can do that. History informs us, and we can do better. So thank you for bringing the bill. I absolutely support it, and I'm looking forward to having it in place.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Agbaje, thank you for this bill, and It's no surprise that I really value keeping families together. That is, in the majority of cases, what's best for kids. poverty should not play into that. Race should not play into that. An over-aggressive government coming in and snatching kids from households should not play into that. And so I one of the things that really, as I read the bill, was emphasized in my mind, in my work over the years here to try to get equal shared parenting, was that you're involving that non-custodial parent, and that's who gets first. I mean, you go to them first. And I've spoken with leaders in the African-American community, and they very much, these fathers in particular, want to be involved in their kids' lives. They want to step up and be involved. And sometimes it's, again, an over-aggressive government that's fencing them out. And so I think this always it has to be the best interest of the kids. But the approach in here globally I support, and I'm grateful to see that you're keeping it first with the non-custodial. I don't ever like those words really, but the non-custodial parent gets, you know, you go to them first and see if they're ready, willing, and able to step up to the plate and step in on behalf of their own child. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'll just say, and I think it's important to sort of, like, for the record, because I think things got a little twisted in the outside conversations and some of the emails that I was receiving. And I know, you know, as a Native person and an attorney, you know, many people have compared this bill to MIFPA and ICWA, but the important thing to just note is that for Indian children under the law, that is a political identity, which is different than a racial or cultural identity. So I think some of the folks who have been wanting to be helpful in that space and sort of recognizing that, you know, the Constitution and the laws, and to what Vice Chair Frazier said, those laws and the Constitution were set up by not the people most impacted by these bills. And so we do have to be sort of clever and figure out a way to still get the results that we need to find for our children while making sure that we don't run afoul of the Constitution, because ultimately none of the good that we're trying to do here can be done if this gets thrown out by a court because it's found to be unconstitutional. And I really appreciate adding the severability piece. I think by bringing up the constitutionality, it was never the goal that was a reason to not move the bill forward. It was just a call to, like, let's figure out how to make sure that this is good and solid and can move forward. And so I do think it's important to note that, you know, those of us who were speaking the constitutionality piece were not speaking to it as a roadblock to the efforts of this bill, but to make sure that we get it right, because as we've seen when ICWA has gone up to the Supreme Court, that's a really scary thing, to have the outcomes for your children be tied up in old legal arguments. And so I appreciate the severability piece, and I think that is important to sort of note. And I think also extending the things in this bill to other disproportionately represented communities. We know the overlap. We know the overlap with low-income folks and our communities. We know that. But I think expanding that and making sure that all kids that are disproportionately represented are part of that as well. So I just really appreciate all the amount of work that you have done to get to this point. And I know the amount of work that, you know, those that came before you, you know, Representative Moran, working on this for a long time too. So I really appreciate everybody who's done the work to get this far. Representative Badgey, closing comments on your bill.
Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to dive into this with all of you. As we've heard, you know, this is an issue that goes back basically to the founding of this country, even before then. We do know that the data says that kids do better when they're with their families, regardless of what the situation that family is in. And as long as that child is safe, they deserve every opportunity to stay with their family. And I really appreciate Representative Niska for sharing your story, because that actually is the kind of outcome that would happen under this bill. Your daughter got to stay with her family, and that's what we want to see happen. So I appreciate all the comments, the questions, the concerns. We are still taking all of those in as this bill moves forward. We will continue to fine-tune a lot of the pieces. I know there are folks that I still have to have continued conversations with, and we will be doing that to making sure that we have a bill that is most impactful to ensure that our Black children, our children of color, our kids who are disabled, regardless of what your circumstances, that you have the opportunity to live and stay with your family, should that be in your best interest.
All right. Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion to refer House File 912 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. With that, that wraps up our work today. We will not meet this Thursday due to the break, but we will see you all next week. With that, we are adjourned.